1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Albums. I'm Red Beard, and today in the studio, we mark the Barisky head transplant performed successfully on one of America's most popular bands.
Hello, baby!
Bottom line is, 5150 was a great record. We went in the studio and we made a great record. It's like a great, energetic, flying, screaming piece of art, you know? And I think if we'd have made a crap record, then it wouldn't have worked, you know, flat out. That's what it wouldn't have worked. And I had no doubt so that we were going to make a great record. Hey, this is Sammy Hagar in the studio with Van Halen's 5150.
Four out of five doctors agree. A lead singer transplant on a superstar band has just about the lowest success rate of anything in the music business. The mere thought of a high-profile lead singer defecting at the peak of a band's popularity can send a veteran record label executive or band manager into cardiac arrest. Yet in 1985, that's exactly what happened to arguably the biggest band in America, Van Halen. For 15 months prior, Van Halen had practically ruled the hard rock throne with the album 1984, selling 10 million copies, and that tour selling out multiple nights coast to coast. Then, after flamboyant lead singer David Lee Roth's first solo album was also a hit, Roth announced he was leaving Van Halen, stunning fans, dividing band management, shocking their record label executives, and leaving the question of Van Halen's future dangling in midair. While Roth's departure appeared sudden to the rest of the rock world, it turns out that personality differences between him and the rest of Van Halen had been a long-standing source of irritation. It extended to things as personal as what each band member should wear. According to first guitarist Eddie Van Halen and then drummer Alex Van Halen in the studio.
From the very beginning, we just felt like, okay, Dave, if that was what you want me to wear, okay, you know?
Yeah,
he used to rag my ass about the way I dressed.
So one day I wore a dress.
Yeah, he did. He wore a dress. Yeah.
The worst part was driving. The thing you have to remember in music, there is a creative side. There is the what I guess we'll call the self-indulgent side, meaning how you want to express yourself. But there's also a side of other people, how they think you should appear. If you're going to play a wedding, you have to wear a tuxedo, or else you ain't getting the gig. It's that simple. At that time, people were so image conscious, or at least to a certain extent of how things should look, like you said, with the poofy hair and the rest of the stuff. To be quite honest with you, even now, things have changed to the point where now people are trying so hard
not to
be something. They shave their heads. They pierce every part of their body they can imagine. You know, 10 years from now.
Ugly is in.
No, I wouldn't say ugly,
well,
but
it's just
human nature. That's all it is.
But
it's very simple. Because the bottom line is, when you
close your eyes and listen to music, what's the damn difference?
When you were born, we didn't know about shirts or pants. We didn't speak the English language. No, but because you hang with other people, you have to communicate.
Yeah.
And certain people relate to certain ways, whether it's a dress or the language or the look. It's that simple. We were just jeans and T-shirts.
I recorded all first four records with that same blue shirt.
Hello, baby!
Like, hey, man, you got any specials here tonight? Me and the fellas might be interested in.
What's that? What?
Rack of what? Well, I'll have some of that.
The banging song that leads off the 1986 album 5150 by Van Halen, It's Good Enough for Me. Original former Van Halen bass player, harmony singer too Michael Anthony, contends that the success of David Lee Roth's Crazy from the Heat solo album in 1985 isn't the only reason that Roth eventually left Van Halen.
The thing that was starting to grow with our relationship and between us and Roth, which would eventually come to a head during the 1984 tour, I think, you know, that was part of it also. I remember the first time Ed even got on a keyboard and showed something to Dave, and Dave was like, oh, no, you can't do that. You're a guitar hero. Guitar heroes, you play guitar. You don't play keyboard, man. You are a guitar hero. Do not play keyboard. And, you know, that frustrated him also because, you know, it wasn't like a conscious thing that, hey, we ought to add keyboard or whatever. But, you know, it was just another facet of Ed Van Halen. That guy... since the first day I met him, he's always messing, goofing around with different instruments, trying to make, you know, or coming up with different sounds, and you know, not because he's searching for something, but because he enjoys doing it. And I think, you know, a lot, it was just a combination of everything. Plus, like, you know, there was some substance abuse, you know, within the band back then too. But I think it was just kind of a culmination of all that.
And then there's the fact that then lead singer, lyricist David Lee Roth, never quite clicked with Eddie Van Halen's bride, Valerie Bertinelli.
Right. Yeah, you could always feel the tension in the room when those two either were talking with each other or, you know, I mean, they got along. You could tell they got along. And, you know, I know Dave was also doing it for Ed's sake, you know, to you didn't want any tension within the band, but you could tell that, you know, that something wasn't right there. That, and plus, Valerie, she's very opinionated and very strong-willed. And, you know, she would say, if she didn't think that something was right, let's say if Dave had Ed wearing something or whatever, she'd go, Ed, I don't think that looks right. You know, you ought to tell Dave and whatever. And up to that point, you know, we had been pretty passive with Dave as far as a lot of things concerning the band, like the interviews, stuff like that. And all of a sudden... is like Ed was going, hey, Dave, you know, I don't think blah, blah, blah. And it's like, ooh. And I think, and Dave knew that Valerie was a part of that. And I think that even, you know, made the tension even worse.
At the same time that Van Halen found themselves without a frontman mid-1985, veteran San Francisco Bay Area rocker Sammy Hagar was just savoring the view from the peak of a long career climb.
Well, I'd just done a year-long tour for the VOA album, VOA tour, which was at that date, you know, my most successful album. And I'd had, you know, really good success touring for a long time, but I had never had the platinum albums until I signed with Geffen in 81. It was Standing Hamp was my first, you know, million seller, and then of course Three Lock Box again, and then VOA was kind of more like an instant million seller, and the momentum was really building, and I went out and did incredible concert business. You know, for me, it was like real exciting. Everything was sold out, and I'd put a second night on everywhere and all that. And I was just, you know, dream come true time. After all the hard work in my whole career from Montrose up till then, I'm going, all right, it finally happened, you know. You know, finally the the big time success, you know. And so I was excited about that. When that tour ended, I was really just beat, though, you know, because there was so much to do. It's the first time I ever did multiples everywhere almost, you know. I did two nights and almost everywhere. And so it took a long time to tour, if you know what I mean. And so I was tired and beat, and I wasn't home 2 weeks till, you know, Eddie called me up. And be honest with you, like I said, I've said this a million times, I was not interested in jumping into a band. You know, I had just gotten where I wanted to be, you know, and I was ready to start writing in a few months and start another album eventually, you know. But I mean, I was really into taking some time off. I liked the band. I'd been on shows with them. I'd seen them. But I always was impressed, you know, of course, with the musicianship in the band. And that 1984, I really was impressed with the fact that Eddie could play keyboards like that. I had no idea. And so his respect doubled for me when I heard 1984. I was out there, you know, on the VOA tour, and you know, I was listening to that 1984 record, I got to admit, you know, and I was buying it. I'm going, whoa, you know, this guy is bad, you know. So I was impressed. And that thing, Beat It, you know, that came out right for then, playing with Michael Jackson. And that kind of put Eddie in another league to me as well, that he could play on a sophisticated record like that. You know, Quincy Jones, the way he produces is like slick upon slick. And Michael's pretty slick himself. But for Eddie to be able to step in there and do his thing and have it still be cool, you know, I thought, yeah, that's pretty cool. The guy's, you know, pretty invincible, you know. So anyway, he had my respect completely. And when Dave left, I thought, really funny. And I had told my wife Betsy at that time, when I was still married, I said, they're probably going to call me up and ask me to join the band. And I swear it wasn't 2 weeks later it did.
Hey!
That's Van Halen with Summer Nights from the album 5150. Up next, you'll hear more from Eddie and Alex Van Halen plus Sammy Hagar telling about the very first time they ever made music together. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online 24/7 at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for Van Halen's number one selling album, 5150.
Hi, I'm Alex Van Halen, and you're not.
Hey, this is Eddie Van Halen in the studio.
Hey, Michael Anthony here, and I'm in the studio right now.
Hey, this is Sammy Hagar in the studio with Van Halen's 5150.
Thanks, Sammy. I'm Redbeard, the historic crossroads for not just one, but two of rock's biggest stars, Van Halen and Sammy Hagar. Talking to the brothers Van Halen, it appears that as they grew up in Pasadena, California, in a real-life Fast Times at Ridgemont High world, Alex Van Halen and his younger brother Eddie developed a bit of a notorious rep.
No different than, I think, anybody else who is searching for something in their life when...
We never hurt anybody, put it that way.
Nothing was ever done maliciously, but Ed and I always had this whether it's an itch or a desire or a need to express ourselves a certain way. And fortunately, we found music. And fortunately, it happened at an early age. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, because that's why some people turn to drugs, some people turn to violence, some people turn to football, whatever it is. You need to have some way to express yourself. And yeah, when we were in our so-called formative years, Ed and I used to get in some rumbles, you know, big deal. But when we finally got the band, what we thought was in a reasonable position of competence, if you want to call it that, we used to play for the Hells Angels. Remember those guys? You know, just sit there and hang around with a bunch of guys. I was just waiting to make a mistake, for having all those guys grab a chain and just wrap it around my neck and say, "Hey, you made a mistake, mother."
Winding me up inside every time we touch.
first advance single from the 5150 album in March 1986 was a big hit for the new Van Halen lineup called Why Can't This Be Love? I asked Sammy Hagar what his take was on the whole situation as he approached that first meeting with the Van Halen brothers in 1985.
The feeling I get, you know, is that that band was doomed because Dave was just totally going off on his trip. And it just, I don't think they could have done another record. And if they would have, it probably would have split up in the middle of it. I mean, you know, bands are fragile. When you got four or more members, God help the big bands. But, you know, just the four of us, it's more difficult than you think staying together for a long time. Because under creative conditions, when you got creative people, you know, you got three extremely creative people in this band. And the point is when you got that many people creating together, if you don't get along, man, nothing can happen. It's difficult to create together not getting along. When you're getting along great, it's all great. But when you disagree, you got three different people to fight about it, and it can be difficult. So I can see what happened, you know, with Dave after a long period of time growing up together and all that kind of shoot, man, you know, pretty soon you just start arguing about, this is the way I want to do it. Well, this is the way I want it. Then you go, well, I'll just go do it myself. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Everything has its place. Look, if Dave wouldn't have left the band, I'd have never been in it. So I'm glad it happened, you know.
Sammy Hagar will never forget that first meeting and rehearsal with the other members of Van Halen at Eddie Van Halen's home studio, which is called 5150, which is police code for escaped mental patient.
I got there about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had to wake Eddie up because he was burnt, man. I mean, he came out with these pair of shades he picked up off the table that somebody, I think, had sat on or something, and just stuck them on real quick and was trying to get a shirt and a pair of pants on. And he was rough, man. I'm telling you, I've been around Eddie for years now, and this is probably the roughest I ever saw him, was my first meeting with him. But and he was, you know, smoking a cigarette and drinking a beer right out of bed. I'm going, whoa, man, these guys, uh-oh. So, I realized later that it was his insecurities. They stayed up all night trying to prepare a couple things to jam, and so that's how far they were. You know, Eddie's always got some music stuff he's working on and, you know, little riffs and stuff, but they didn't have a couple solid songs. They had Summer Nights, which became Summer Nights, and Good Enough, what became Good Enough. And they had worked them up all night, Ed and Al and Mike. And so Al comes driving up later. He looked about as bad as Ed. He has a couple of tall cans in each pocket. You know, and they were rocking, man. They were drinking pretty heavy back then, and I thought, wow, man, these guys, I hope they don't do this all the time, you know. And I'm going, man, look, I get up in the morning with my kids, and I visit with my kids, and I get home in time to spend some time before to tuck them in, you know, if I'm home. I mean, I'm on the road so much that my rules are when I'm home or I'm in the studio, I take the time to you know, be with my kids. And I'm going, so I am not going to start working at midnight and go home, you know, at 10 o'clock in the morning and then sleep all day, you know. Just that is not my schedule. So, I mean, that's one thing that I think I brought to this band, honestly, was a little more of a little discipline. That's exactly what it is. So, and not getting trashed and passing out in the middle of a session.
I asked Sammy Hagar what musical common ground that he found that he shared with Eddie Van Halen.
Oh, Cream. The group Cream. Led Zeppelin, of course, but Cream, man, Ed and I, Clapton, man, we were just Clapton heads, both of us, and, you know, that's where my guitar playing came from, that's where his guitar playing, it came from, you know, not his hammer style, but, you know, his riff style, and his sort of sound and phrasing, and, you know, Ed's got a lot of Clapton in him, man, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, it's beautiful. Clapton's one of the most tasteful guitar players ever lived, and so that was it, you know. Just Cream was just such a common denominator, you know, that not that we said like Cream, but, you know, it was like what was understood need not be discussed, you know. It was like that was just the Bible was Cream records. I thought possibly the reason it wouldn't work was because I am a definite kind of person, you know what I mean? You see me on stage, fans have seen me from the beginning of time till now know that I'm pretty much the same guy. I think I've gotten better, but I'm still the same person on stage. I'm kind of a solid, you know, I smell like myself, you know. And I thought that maybe because of that, they might want me to change, or they might want me to be, you know, like more like Dave was or something, you know, put on funny clothes and stuff, you know, and I pretty much was myself, and I'm going, I'm just going to come into this thing and be myself, and if that don't work, then it don't work. But when I got there and saw, you know, just being myself, how well it did work, that my style of singing and my style of lyrics and my personality and everything, just, man, the four of us just gelled. It was like we got along great, man, better than any band I'd ever been in. And the thing that, if you're asking me how come it worked, how come they could change singers and how come it could work, without taking credit away from me or taking credit away from Eddie or anybody else in the band, the bottom line is 5150 was a great record. We went in the studio and we made a great record. It's like a great, energetic, flying, screaming piece of art, you know? And I think if we'd have made a crap record, then it wouldn't have worked, you know, flat out. That's what it wouldn't have worked. And I had no doubt so that we were going to make a great record. You know, we're all professionals and we're talented. So, but really, I think that's the main key, was that Van Halen had some solid fans. Sammy Hagar had some solid fans. That was pretty much an automatic. The record was going to be fairly successful. But if the record wouldn't have been good, it wouldn't have went on this long. Every record we've made has been great, and we work hard to make sure they're great, and we try to outdo ourselves every time, or at least be as honest with ourselves every time. And I think that's why it's been successful, and that's the main key, I think.
So Sammy Hagar joined Van Halen, and together they wrote and recorded all through the fall and winter of 1985. At the very end of the project, Mick Jones of Foreigner was brought in to produce vocals on a couple of songs, according to Sammy.
He would get real excited when I would really be kicking it, you know, and that, you know, that's good for a singer. For anyone out there that's a singer, or anyone out there that is a producer, singers, as singers well know, you know, you get real sensitive because it's coming out of your body, you know, and if you hit a bad note, you can't blame it on the amp or the guitar or anything. And so you kind of, it's real sensitive singing. It's really bearing your soul to the bone. It's the closest thing to explaining who you are in your voice, is when you sing honestly and close your eyes and just let it come out. And when people encourage you when you're singing, it really, really makes it easier and better. And Mick did a lot of that for me, and he really got some good vocals out of me. Hey, Dreams is one of the great vocals all you've ever done and ever will be able to do in my whole life.
What a great song was Dreams from 5150. When we return, the new Van Halen debuts to instant multi-million sales and a sold-out tour. But that new lineup and sound will not be without controversy. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. Sammy Hagar pulls no punches next In the Studio, Van Halen's number one selling album, 5150.
Hi, I'm Alex Van Halen, and you're not.
Hey, this is Eddie Van Halen in the studio.
Hey, Michael Anthony here, and I'm in the studio right now.
Hey, this is Sammy Hagar in the studio with Van Halen's 5150.
Thanks again, Sam. In joining Van Halen, Sammy Hagar had to go from being the leader in his own solo career to one of only two non-family members in a van that bears the family name Van Halen. I asked Sammy Hagar about the brother thing.
I love it. See, this is one thing where I can humble myself and say I'm jealous of that, of those two guys being so close. And, you know, they'll fight. Ed and Al, man, they fight more than any one of us in the band. Not necessarily so much anymore, but back when they were drinking heavy, man, those guys would get into it, you know. But if you tried to get into it with one of them, the other guy was obviously going to stick in with his brother, man. So, you know, I always feel like, oh, boy, these guys, you know. So I'm always joking about, so yeah, you know, well, the brothers. I refer to anything in this band as the brothers because they're the ones that you're going to go, if one of those guys disagree, you know, you don't even have to. The other guy can be at home asleep, man, and his vote's already counted, man. So it's cool, you know. It kind of keeps the band closer in one sense because those guys are so close that as long as they don't go on any trips about being and hoarding their friendship and their loyalty to each other amongst themselves and put everybody else on the outside, as long as they don't do that, you've got a real tight-knit thing. You know, they have to be always, you know, something that they have to do is be open to the fact that everybody is an outsider, and so they have to always learn and be on their toes about keeping you feeling comfortable around them as well. You know, I mean, I'm talking about when things are tough, you know, when you're going at it, so that they don't close down and just shut everybody out, because, you know, that can break a band up too. I mean, it's delicate. It's got a positive and a negative, like everything else. You know, it's yin and yang. It's life.
I need more than just words to say. I need
Now, that's a song that Eddie was working on by himself with a drum machine, and he just had a guitar plugged straight through the board, not through an amp, and it was real clean, and it sounded kind of like Staple Singers. Remember, Pop Staples had that kind of funky guitar tone. It was, you know, real clean. And he was playing it like that, and he was humming his melody during the verses, you know, and it was kind of the melody. It's the melody that I really worked off. You know, most of the time, Edward doesn't get involved with, you know, what I sing, but on this song, he kind of had an idea for the verse, because, you know, and I started singing along with that, and then I didn't have a lyric idea. I was just jamming, doing, you know, that kind of stuff, and that's the way I would sing along the songs, you know, and then I went home, and I was in the shower the next morning. I'm thinking about it all night, no title, no nothing. Man, I'm in the shower. I'm soaking soap, man. My hair's got shampoo in it, and all of a sudden it hit. I want the best. Come up. And I jumped out of the shower, soaking wet shampoo, hollering, give me a pen and a paper. And I started writing it. And I sat there with dripping wet and completely shampooed and honestly, soap all over me, and I wrote that out just like it played itself right through. I don't know what I've been living on, but you know, right on down the line, man, right on through the end. And I came in, I'm jacked, I'm going, yes. And I sang it. It was one of them beautiful things that just popped out all at once, you know, not a little at a time.
Well, the 5150 album exploded in the spring of 1986. The tour was a virtual sellout, including a stop that summer as the headliner on the 1986 Texas Jam at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas in front of 70,000. In his autobiography, Red, My Uncensored Life in Rock, Sammy Hagar laments that despite selling multi-million copies and it being the number one album in America, some music critics and David Lee Roth fans simply couldn't accept the fact that Roth had left Van Halen and decided to vent their dissatisfaction on the only person in the scenario who had absolutely nothing to do with causing it, Sammy Hagar.
Well, it was mainly just media. You know, the fans that came to the shows, 99.999% of them came because they knew who we were and what it was. And if there was any negativity out there, I certainly couldn't see it because the people in the front row, man, were there to see Van Halen or see Sammy Hagar. You know, everyone knows I joined a band. Everyone knew that I was going to be on stage. Don't be bringing a sign that says, where is Roth? Well, who knows? You know, I don't know where he is. You know, if you're looking for him, you could probably check the newspapers or something, you know, or go down to the post office. But so, you know, it's just one of those stupid things. That didn't bother me at all. But that happened maybe three times. I mean, out of every show we've ever done, I've maybe seen that three times. But the thing that really got to me were the critics that really, really, you know, not all of them, but a lot of journalists drugged me through the coals. There was always that thing. It was either black or white, man. It was going to be either, wow, what a relief. This band is 100 times better. And wow, what a great show, Van Halen. It's about time they got someone up there that, you know, was into the music and, you know, was working with the other guys and blah, blah, blah. It would either be real positive like that or it would be, man, you know, where's Dave? Without that, this is just a common, ordinary rock show. And Sammy Hagar's, you know, can't do this, can't do that. He's not a showman. He's, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, it was just, they would, but sometimes guys would just go after me, man, like big time. Like, you know, praise, you know, Ed, praise Alan, praise Mike, and then just rip me to shreds. And that bothered me. And I hate to say that because there's always that chump out there that's going to say, oh, I'll get him next time he comes to town. If that bothers him, well, let me stick a knife in his back. But that really bothered me. Those, when they would go after me specifically, I never stopped worrying about it. It still bothers me to get a bad review. If I went out and did a great show and put my heart into it, because I'm an honest performer, you know, I'm not contrived. I don't, anyone that's seen, you know, 10 Van Halen shows or 10 Sammy Hagar shows, it doesn't matter. Anyone that's seen me on stage in any situation more than once knows I don't do, say, or wear the same thing every time. And it's an honest performance. It's an honest rap. Half what I consider what I do on stage is relate to the audience and talk to them like humans about where my head's at or where the event's at or where I think they're at or something funny. But whatever. I just come out with whatever I feel that night. Sometimes better than others, but always honest.
And those internal challenges to Van Halen's success that became apparent to Sammy Hagar even at that very first rehearsal, they were more highly personal than musical, but much more daunting. There was obvious heavy drinking then by Alex, Eddie, and the Van Halen's father, Jan. Tragically, Alex, Eddie, and Sammy would all lose their fathers to alcoholism. I asked Sammy Hagar if being the child of an alcoholic parent gave him some insight when he joined Van Halen.
Honestly, one of the things we had in common, like I said, but what was understood need not be discussed. We never really talked about it too much. I knew Ed's father, and so Ed and Al's father, I knew Jan. He was cool. He was a musician. He was hanging around the studio 5150 record all the time. And, you know, having beers and smoking cigarettes with the brothers. And he was almost like the fifth member of the band. Well, he was one of the boys. It was great. He's a good, good, good man. And I get little goosebumps on me just thinking about how cool, you know, it was having your father there while you're making music. Wow. I mean, you know, see, I miss that. I never got that. Here I am jealous again, you know. But it's one of the things that made me probably have a lot more, you know, sympathy for them and more tolerant of them when they would piss me off for being too drunk or something, you know, and not very communicative. They couldn't communicate very well, and it would just, you know, things would go sideways once in a while. I'd have to blow the night off because they'd be too wasted. But at the same time, I knew their father, I knew my father, and I thought, you know, this is a problem, and it has to be worked on and taken care of, but I'm certainly not going to just throw these guys out of my life or me walk out of their life, whatever, because of it. I would rather, I can deal with it. You know, it's a problem, but I can deal with it. I had more sympathy for it, more, a little bit more understanding. I had a more compassionate relationship about it, you know, than some people would, I think. The transformation that Alex made when he stopped drinking, Alex, I respect so much for doing what he did. He took the oath, and then boom, he didn't fall down. You know, he didn't go back and forth. This guy, very, very cool, and really, he's a sharp guy, and he's just like Sim, and he was drinking. The guy was a nut. I mean, I didn't realize that he was just drunk all the time when I first met him. I thought he was just a nut. I thought, man, this guy is nuts, man. He does the craziest things I've ever seen. But you know, Al's he's something else, man. But he's really a different guy. And boy, I love him a lot better. I tell Edward the same thing. You know, I just said, Ed, you know, for the day he had been sober for, I think, for the first month, you know, I just wrote him a note. And I said, Ed, you know, I said, I love you, you know, when you're drunk, but I like you a lot better when you're sober.
A song that the original Van Halen band could never have pulled off is Love Walks In, of the album 5150 by Van Halen. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking all my guests, Eddie and Alex Van Halen, Michael Anthony, and Sammy Hager. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.